Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Out of Body by Jennifer Egan. Your friends are pretending to be all kinds of stuff, and your special job is to call them on it. Drew says he's going straight to law school. After practicing a while, he'll run for state senator, then U.S. senator, eventually president. He lays all this out the way you'd say, after modern Chinese painting, I'll go to the gym, then work in Bob's until dinner. If you even made plans anymore, which you don't. If you were even in school anymore, which you aren't, although that's supposedly temporary. You look at Drew through layers of hash smoke floating in the sun. He's leaning back on the futon couch, his arm around Sasha. He's got a big, hey, come on in face and a head of dark hair, and he's built, not with weight room muscle like yours, but in a basic animal way that must come from all that swimming he does. Just don't try and say you didn't inhale, you tell him. Everyone laughs except Bix, who's at his computer, and you feel like a funny guy for maybe half a second, until it occurs to you that they probably only laughed because they could see you were trying to be funny, and they're afraid you'll jump out the window onto East 7th Street if you fail even at something so small. Drew takes a long hit. You hear the smoke creak in his chest. He hands the pipe to Sasha, who passes it to Lizzie without smoking any. I promise, Rob, Drew croaks at you, holding in smoke. If anyone asks, I'll tell them the hash I smoked with Robert Freeman Jr. was excellent. Was that Jr. mocking? The hash is not working out as planned. You're just as paranoid as with pot. You decide, no, Drew doesn't mock. Drew is a believer. Last fall, he was one of the diehards passing out leaflets in Washington Square and registering students to vote. After he and Sasha got together, you started helping him. Mostly with the jocks, because you know how to talk to them. Coach Freeman, a.k.a. your pop, calls Drew's type woodsy. They're loners, Pop says. Skiers, woodchoppers, not team players. But you know all about teams. You can talk to people on teams. Only Sasha knows you picked NYU because it hasn't had a football team in 30 years. On your best day, you registered 12 team-playing Democrats, prompting Drew to exclaim when you gave him the paperwork, "You've got the touch, Rob." But you never registered yourself. That was the thing, and the longer you waited, the more ashamed of this you got. Then it was too late. Even Sasha, who knows all your secrets, has no idea that you never cast a vote for Bill Clinton. Drew leans over and gives Sasha a wet kiss, and you can tell the hash is getting him horny because you feel it too. It makes your teeth ache in a way that will only let up if you hit someone or get hit. In high school, you'd get in fights when you felt like this. But no one will fight with you now. The fact that you hacked open your wrists with a box cutter 3 months ago and nearly bled to death seems to be a deterrent. It functions like a force field, paralyzing everyone in range with an encouraging smile on their lips. You want to hold up a mirror and ask, how exactly are those smiles supposed to help me? No one smokes hash and becomes president, Drew, you say. It'll never happen. This is my period of youthful experimentation, he says, with a sincerity that would be laughable in a person who wasn't from Wisconsin. Besides, he says, who's going to tell them? I am, you say. I love you too, Rob, Drew says, laughing. Who said I loved you, you almost ask. Drew lifts Sasha's hair and twists it into a rope. He kisses the skin under her jaw. You stand up, seething. Bix and Lizzie's apartment is tiny, like a dollhouse. Full of plants and the smell of plants, wet and planty, because Lizzie loves plants. The walls are covered with Bix's collection of Last Judgment posters. Naked, babyish humans getting separated into good and bad, the good ones rising into green fields and golden light, the bad ones vanishing into mouths of monsters. The window is wide open, and you climb onto the fire escape. The March cold crackles your sinuses. Sasha climbs out on the fire escape a second later. What are you doing? She asks. Don't know, you say. Fresh air. You wonder how long you can go on speaking in two-word sentences. Nice day. Across East 7th Street, two old ladies have folded bath towels on their windowsills and are resting their elbows on them while they peer down at the street below. "Look there," you say, pointing. "Two spies." "It makes me nervous, Bobby," Sasha says. "You out here." She's the only one who gets to call you that. You were Bobby until you were 10, but according to your pop, it's a girl's name after that. "How come?" you say. "Third floor, broken arm or leg. Worst case. Please come in." "Relax, Sash." You park yourself on the grill steps leading up to the fourth floor windows. "Party migrate out here?" Drew origamis himself through the living room window onto the fire escape and leans over the railing to look down at the street. From inside, you hear Lizzie answer the phone. "Hi, Mom," trying to fluff the hash out of her voice. Her parents are visiting from Texas, which means that Bix, who's black, is spending his nights in the electrical engineering lab where he's doing his PhD research. Lizzie's parents aren't even staying with her. They're at a hotel. But if Lizzie is sleeping with a black man in the same city where her parents are, they will just know. Lizzie pokes her torso out of the window. She's wearing a tiny blue skirt and tan patent leather boots that go up higher than her knees. To herself, she's already a costume designer. "How's the bigot?" you ask, realizing with chagrin that the sentence has three words. Lizzie turns to you, startled. "Are you referring to my mother?" "Not me." "You can't talk that way in my apartment, Rob," she says, using the calm voice they've all been using since you got back, a voice that leaves you no choice but to see how hard you have to push before it cracks. "I'm not," you indicate the fire escape, "or on my fire escape." "Not yours," you correct her. "Bix's, too. Actually, no, the city's." "Fuck you, Rob," Lizzie says. "You too," you say, grinning with satisfaction at the sight of real anger on a human face. "It's been a while." "Calm down," Sasha tells Lizzie. "Excuse me? I should calm down," Lizzie says. "He's being a total asshole ever since he got back." "He's been back 2 weeks," Sasha says. "That's not very long." "I love how they talk about me like I'm not here," you observe to Drew. "Do they think I'm dead?" "They think you're stoned." "They're correct." "Me too." Drew climbs the fire escape until he's a few steps above you and perches there. He takes a long breath, savoring it, and you take one too. In Wisconsin, Drew has shot an elk with a bow and arrow, skinned it, cut off the meat into sections, and carried it home in a backpack wearing snowshoes. Or maybe he was kidding. He and his brothers built a log cabin with their bare hands. He grew up next to a lake, and every morning, even in winter, Drew swam there. Now he swims in the NYU pool, but the chlorine hurts his eyes, and it's not the same, he says, with the ceiling over you. Still, he swims there a lot, especially when he's troubled or stressed or in a fight with Sasha. "You must have grown up swimming," he said, when he first heard you were from Florida, and you said, "Of course." But the truth is, you've never liked the water, something only Sasha knows about you. You lurch from the steps to the other end of the fire escape platform, where a window looks into the little alcove where Bix's computer lives. Bix is in front of it, dreadlocks thick as cigars, typing messages to other graduate students that they'll read on their computers, and reading messages they send back. According to Bix, this computer message sending is going to be huge, bigger than the telephone. He's big on predicting the future, and you haven't really challenged him. Maybe because he's older, maybe because he's black. Bix jumps at the sight of you looming outside his window in your baggy jeans and football jersey, which you've taken to wearing again for some reason. "Shit, Rob," he says. "What are you doing out there?" "Watching you." "You've got Lizzie all stressed out." "I'm sorry." "So get in here and tell her that." You climb in through Bix's window. There's a Last Judgment poster hanging right over his desk from the Albee Cathedral. You remember it from your intro to art history class last year, a class you loved so much you added art history to your business major. You wonder if Bix is religious. In the living room, Sasha and Lizzie are sitting on the futon couch looking grim. Drew is still out on the fire escape. "I'm sorry," you tell Lizzie. "It's okay," she says, "and you know you should leave it there. It's fine. Leave it alone. But some crazy engine inside of you won't let you stop. I'm sorry your mom is a bigot. I'm sorry Bix has to have a girlfriend from Texas. I'm sorry I'm an asshole. I'm sorry I make you nervous because I tried to kill myself. I'm sorry to get in the way of your nice afternoon." Your throat tightens up and your eyes get wet as you watch their faces go from stony to sad. And it's all kind of moving and sweet except that you're not completely there. A part of you is a few feet away or above, thinking, good, they'll forgive you, they won't desert you. And the question is, which one is really you? The one saying and doing whatever it is, or the one watching? You leave Bix and Lizzie's with Sasha and Drew and head west toward Washington Square. The cold spasms in the scars of your wrists. Sasha and Drew are a braid of elbows and shoulders and pockets, which presumably keep them warmer than you. When you were back in Tampa, recovering, they took a Greyhound to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration and stayed up all night and watched the sunrise over the mall, at which point, they both say, they felt the world start to change right under their feet. You snickered when Sasha told you this, but ever since you find yourself watching strangers' faces on the street and wondering if they feel it too, a change having to do with Bill Clinton or something even bigger that's everywhere, in the air, underground, obvious to everyone but you. At Washington Square, you and Sasha say goodbye to Drew, who peels off to take a swim and wash the hash from his head. Sasha's wearing her backpack, heading for the library. Thank God, you say, he's gone. You can't seem to stop talking in two-word sentences now, even though you'd like to. Nice, Sasha remarks. I'm kidding, he's great. I know. Your high is wearing off, leaving a box of lint where your head should be. Getting high is new for you. Your not getting high was the whole reason Sasha picked you out the first day of classes last year in Washington Square. Blocking your sun with her henna red hair. Smart, quick eyes looking at you from the side rather than head on. I'm in need of a fake boyfriend, she said. Are you up for it? How about your real one, you said. She sat down beside you and laid things out. In high school, back in L.A., she'd run away with the drummer for a band you'd never heard of, left the country and traveled alone in Europe and Asia, never even graduated. Now, a freshman, she was almost 21. Her stepfather had pulled every string to get her in here. Last week, he'd told her he was hiring a detective to make sure she towed the line on her own in New York. Someone could be watching me right now, she said, looking across the square, crowded with kids who all seemed to know each other. I feel like someone is. Should I put my arm around you? Please. You've heard somewhere that the act of smiling makes people feel happier. Putting your arm around Sasha made you want to protect her. Why me, you asked, out of curiosity. You're cute, she said. Plus, you don't look druggy. I'm a football player, you said. Was. You and Sasha had books to buy. You bought them together. You visited her dorm, where you caught Lizzie, her roommate, mugging approval when your back was turned. At 5:30, you were both loading your cafeteria trays, you going heavy on the spinach because everyone says football muscle turns to jello when you stop playing. You both got your library cards, went back to your dorms, then met at the Apple for drinks at 8 o'clock. It was packed with students. Sasha kept glancing around, and you figured she was thinking about the detective, so you put your arm around her and kissed the side of her face and her hair, which had a nice burned smell, the not-realness of it all relaxing you in a way you'd never managed to be with girls at home. At which point, Sasha explained step two. Each of you had to tell the others something that would make it impossible for you to ever really go out. Have you done this before? You asked, incredulous. She'd drunk two white wines, which you'd matched 2-1 with beers, and was starting on her third. Of course not. So, I tell you I used to torture kitty cats, and that stops you from wanting to jump my bones? Did you? Fuck no. I'll go first, Sasha said. She'd started shoplifting at 13 with her girlfriends, hiding beaded combs and sparkly earrings inside their sleeves, seeing who could get away with more. But it was different for Sasha. It made her whole body glow. Later at school, she'd replay every step of what had happened, counting the days until they could do it again. The other girls were nervous, competitive, and Sasha struggled to show only that much. In Naples, when she ran out of money, she stole things from stores and sold them to Lars the Swede, waiting her turn on his kitchen floor with other hungry kids holding tourist wallets, costume jewelry, American passports. They grumbled about Lars, who never gave them what they deserved. He'd played the flute in concerts back in Sweden, supposedly, but the source of that rumor might have been Lars himself. They weren't allowed beyond his kitchen, but someone had glimpsed a piano through a closing door, and Sasha often heard a baby crying. Her first time, Lars made Sasha wait longer than anyone, holding a pair of spangly platform shoes she'd taken from a boutique. and when everyone else was paid and gone, he had squatted beside her on the kitchen floor and unbuttoned his pants. For months, she'd done business with Lars, arriving sometimes without having managed to take anything, just needing money. "I thought he was my boyfriend," she said, "but I think I wasn't thinking any more." She was better now, hadn't stolen anything in 2 years. "That wasn't me in Naples," she told you, looking out at the room. "I don't know who it was. I feel sorry for her." And maybe from a sense that she dared you, or that anything at all could be said in the chamber of truth where you and Sasha now found yourselves, or that she'd blown out a vacuum some law of physics required that you fill, you told her about James, your teammate, how one night the two of you took out two girls in your pop's car, and after you brought them home, early, it was a game night, you and James drove to a secluded place and spent maybe an hour alone in the car. It happened just that one time, without discussion or agreement. The two of you had barely spoken after that. At times you'd wondered if you'd made it up. "I'm not a fag," you told Sasha. "It wasn't you in the car with James. You were somewhere else, looking down, thinking, 'That fag is fooling around with another guy. How can he do that? How can he want it? How can he live with himself?'" In the library, Sasha spends 2 hours typing a paper on Mozart's early life and sneaking sips of a Diet Coke. Being older, she feels behind. She's taking 6 courses a semester plus summer school so she can graduate in 3 years. She's a business-slash-arts double major, like you, but in music. You rest your head in your arms on the table and sleep until she's done. Then you walk together through the dark to your dorm on 3rd Avenue. You smell popcorn from the elevator. Sure enough, all 3 sweetmates are home, along with Pilar, a girl you quasi-dated last fall to distract yourself after Sasha paired off with Drew. The minute you walk in, the Nirvana volume drops and the windows fly open. You now seem to be in the same category as a professor or a cop. You make people instantly nervous. There's got to be a way to enjoy this. You follow Sasha into her room. Most students' rooms are like hamster burrows lined with scraps and tufts of home, pillows and stuffed doggies and plug-in pots and furry slippers. But Sasha's room is practically empty. She showed up last year with nothing but a suitcase. In one corner is a rented harp she's learning to play. You lie face up on her bed while she gathers her shower bag and green kimono and goes out. She comes back quickly, not wanting to leave you alone, you have a feeling, wearing the kimono, her head in a towel. You watch from the bed as she shakes out her long hair and uses a wide-tooth comb to get the snarls out. Then she slips out of the kimono and starts getting dressed. Lacy black bra and panties, torn jeans, a faded black T-shirt, Doc Martens. Last year, after Bix and Lizzie got together, you started spending nights in Sasha's room, sleeping in Lizzie's empty bed, 3 feet away from Sasha's. You know the scar on her left ankle from a break that had to be operated on when it didn't heal right. You know the Big Dipper of reddish moles around her belly button and her mothball breath when she first wakes up. Everyone assumed you were a couple. It was that deep between you and Sasha. She would cry in her sleep, and you'd climb in her bed and hold her until her breathing got regular and slow. She felt so light in your arms. You'd fall asleep holding her and wake up with a hard-on and just lie there, feeling this body you knew so well, its skin and smells, alongside your own need to fuck someone, waiting for the two to merge into one impulse. Come on, pull this all together and act like someone normal for a change. But you were scared to put your lust to the test, not wanting to ruin it with Sasha if things went wrong. It was the biggest mistake of your life, not fucking Sasha. You saw this with brutal clarity when she fell in love with Drew, and it clobbered you with such remorse that you thought at first you couldn't survive it. You might have held on to Sasha and become normal at the same time, but you didn't even try. You gave up the one chance God threw your way, and now it's too late. Out in the world, Sasha would grab your hand or throw her arms around you and kiss you. That was for the detective. He could be anywhere, watching you toss snowballs in Washington Square, Sasha jumping onto your back, her fluffy mittens leaving fibers on your tongue. He was the invisible companion you saluted over bowls of steamed vegetables at Dojo. "I want him to see me eating healthy food," she said. Occasionally you raised practical questions about the detective. Had her stepfather mentioned him again? Did she know for certain it was a man? How long did she think the surveillance would last? But this line of thinking seemed to irritate Sasha, so you let it go. I want him to know I'm happy, she said. I want him to see me well again, how I'm still normal even after everything. And you wanted that, too. When she met Drew, Sasha forgot about the detective. Drew was detective-proof. Even her stepfather likes him. It's after 10 by the time you and Sasha meet up with Drew on 3rd Avenue and St. Mark's Street. His eyes are bloodshot from swimming. His hair is wet. He kisses Sasha like they've been apart for a week. My older woman, he calls her sometimes, and loves the fact that she's been on her own in the wider world. Of course, Drew knows nothing about how bad things got for Sasha in Naples, and lately you have the feeling she's starting to forget, begin over again as the person she is to Drew. This makes you sick with envy. Why couldn't you do that for Sasha? Who's going to do it for you? On East 7th, you pass Bix and Lizzie's, but the lights are off. Lizzie is out with her parents. The streets are full of people, most of whom seem to be laughing, and you wonder again about that change Sasha felt when the sun rose in Washington, D.C., whether these people feel it too, and their laughter is connected to that. On Avenue A, the three of you stand outside the Pyramid Club, listening. Still the second band, Sasha says, so you walk up the street for egg creams at the Russian newsstand and drink them on a bench in Tompkins Square Park, which just reopened last summer. Look, you say, opening your hand. Three yellow pills. Sasha sighs. She's running out of patience. What are they? Drew asks. E. He has an optimist's attraction to everything new, a faith that it will enrich him, not hurt him. Lately you've found yourself using this quality in Drew, scattering breadcrumbs for him one by one. I want to do it with you, he tells Sasha, but she shakes her head. I missed your druggy moment, he says wistfully. Thank God, Sasha says. You pop one of the pills and put the other two back in your pocket. You start to feel the E as soon as you enter the club. The pyramid is jammed. The conduits have been big on college campuses for years, but Sasha is convinced their new album is total genius and will go multi-platinum. She likes to get right up against the stage, the band in her face, but you need more distance. Drew stays close to Sasha, but when the conduit's nutcase of a lead guitarist, Bosco, starts flinging himself around like a berserk scarecrow, you notice him edging back. You've entered a state of tingling, stomachy happiness that feels the way you hoped adulthood would be as a kid. A blur of lost bearings, release from the drone of meals and homework and church, and that's not a nice way to talk to your sister, Robert Jr. You wanted a brother. You want Drew to be your brother. Then you could have built the log cabin together and slept inside it, snow piling up outside the windows. You could have slaughtered the elk and afterward, slick with blood and fur, peeled off your clothes together beside a bonfire. If you could see Drew naked, even just once, it would ease a deep, awful pressure inside you. Bosco is getting tossed over your head, his shirt gone, skinny torso slimed with beer and sweat. Your hands slip over the flinty muscles of his back. He's still playing his guitar, hollering without a microphone. Drew spots you and moves closer, shaking his head. He'd never been to a concert before he met Sasha. You shimmy one of the remaining yellow pills from your pocket and push it into his hand. Something was funny a while ago, but you can't remember what. Drew doesn't seem to know either, although you're both convulsed with helpless hysterics. Sasha thought you would wait for her inside after the show, so it takes her a while to find the two of you out on the pavement. Her eyes move between you and the acid streetlight. Ah, she says, I get it. Don't be mad, Drew says. He's trying not to look at you. If you look at each other, you're gone. But you can't stop looking at Drew. I'm not mad, Sasha says. I'm bored. The conduit's producer, Benny Salazar, has invited her to a party. I thought we could all go, she tells Drew, but you're too high. He doesn't want to go with you, you bellow, your nose running with laughter and snot. He wants to come with me. That's true, Drew says. Fine, Sasha says angrily. Then everyone's happy. The two of you reel away from her. Hilarity keeps you busy for several blocks, but there's a sickness to it, like an itch that if you keep on scratching will grind straight through skin and muscle and bone, shredding your heart. At one point you both have to stop walking and sit on a stoop, leaning against each other, half sobbing. You buy a gallon of orange juice and guzzle it with Drew on a corner, juice gushing over both your chins and soaking your puffy jackets. You hold the carton upside down above your mouth, catching the last drops in the back of your throat. When you toss it away, the city rises darkly around you. You're on 2nd Street and Avenue B. People are exchanging little vials in their handshakes. But Drew stretches out his arms, feeling the E in his fingertips. You've never seen him afraid, only curious. I feel bad, you say, about Sasha. Don't worry, Drew says. She'll forgive us. After your wrists have been stitched and bandaged and someone else's blood has been pumped inside you and your parents were waiting at the Tampa airport for the first flight out, Sasha pushed aside the IV coils and climbed into your bed at St. Vincent's. Even through the painkillers, there was a thudding ache around your wrists. Bobby, she whispered. Her face was almost touching yours. She was breathing your breath and you were breathing hers, malty from fear and lack of sleep. It was Sasha who found you. 10 more minutes, they said. Bobby, listen to me. You opened your eyes and Sasha's green eyes were right up against them, your lashes interlocking. In Naples, she said, there were kids who were just lost. You knew they were never going to get back to what they'd been or have a normal life. And then there were other ones who you thought, maybe they will. You tried to ask which kind Lars the Swede was, but it came out a mush. Listen, she said, Bobby, in a minute they're going to kick me out. You opened your eyes, which you hadn't realized were shut. What I'm saying is, we're the survivors, Sasha said. She spoke in a way that briefly cleared your head of the sweet, cloudy things they were pumping inside you, like she'd opened an envelope and read a result that you urgently needed to know, like you'd been caught offside and had to be straightened out. Not everyone is, but we are, okay? Okay. She lay alongside you, every part of you touching, like you'd done so many nights before she met Drew. You felt Sasha's strength seeping into your skin. You tried to hold her, but your hands were stuffed animal stumps, and you couldn't move them. Which means you can't do that again, she said. Ever, 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 ever. Do you promise me, Bobby? I promise. And you meant it. You wouldn't break a promise to Sasha. Bix! Drew shouts. He charges up Avenue B, boots clobbering the pavement. Bix is alone, hands in the pockets of his green army jacket. Whoa, he says, laughing when he sees from Drew's eyes how high he is. Your own high is just beginning to teeter. You've been planning to take that last pill, but you offer it to Bix instead. I don't really do this anymore, Bix says, but rules are for bending, right? A custodian made him leave the lab. He's been walking around for 2 hours. And Lizzie's asleep, you say, in your apartment. Bix gives you a cold look that empties your good mood. Let's not get started on that. You walk together, waiting for Bix to come onto the E. It's after 2 a.m., the hour when, it turns out, normal people go home to bed and drunk, crazy, fucked-up people stay out. You don't want to be with those people. You want to go back to your suite and knock on Sasha's door, which she leaves unlocked when Drew isn't spending the night. Earth to Rob, Bix says. His face is soft and his eyes are shiny and bewitched. I was thinking I might go home, you say. You can't, Bix cries. Love for his fellow creatures pulses from within him like an aura. You can feel its glow on your skin. You're central to the action. Right, you mutter. Drew slings his arm around you. He smells like Wisconsin. Woods, fires, ponds. Although you've never been near it. Truth, Robbie says serious. You're our aching, pounding heart. You wind up at an after-hours club Bix knows about on Ludlow, crowded with people too high to go home. You all dance together, subdividing the space between now and tomorrow until time seems to move backward. You share a strong joint with a girl whose bangs are very short, leaving her bright forehead exposed. She dances near you, her arms around your neck, and Drew shouts in your ear over the music. She wants to go home with you, Rob. But eventually the girl gives up, or forgets, or you forget, and she disappears. The sky is just getting light when the three of you leave the club. You walk north together to Leshko's on Avenue A for scrambled eggs and piles of fried potatoes, then stagger, stuffed, back onto the groggy street. Bix is between you and Drew, one arm around each of you. Fire escapes dangle off the sides of buildings. A croupy church bell starts up, and you remember, it's Sunday. Someone seems to be leading the way toward the 6th Street overpass to the East River, but really, you're all moving in tandem, like a Ouija board. The sun blazes into view, spinning bright and metallic against your eyeballs, ionizing the water's surface so you can't see a bit of pollution or crud underneath. It looks mystical, biblical. It raises a lump in your throat. Bix squeezes your shoulder. "Gentlemen," he says, "good morning." You stand together at the river's edge, looking out, the last patches of old snow piled at your feet. "Look at that beautiful water," Drew says. "I wish I could swim in it." After a minute, he says, "Let's remember this day, even when we don't know each other any more." You look over at Drew, squinting in the sun, and for a second the future tunnels away, some version of you at the end of it, looking back. And right then you feel it, what you've seen in people's faces on the street, a swell of movement like an undertow rushing you towards something you can't quite see. "We'll know each other forever," Bix says. "The days of losing touch are almost gone." "What does that mean?" Drew asks. "We're going to meet again in a different space," Bix says. "Everyone we've lost will find, or they'll find us." "Where? How?" Drew asks. Bix hesitates, like he's held this secret so long he's afraid of what will happen when he releases it into the air. "I picture it like Judgment Day," he says, finally, his eyes on the water. "We'll rise up out of our bodies and find each other again in spirit form. We'll meet in that new place, all of us together, and first it'll seem strange, and pretty soon it'll seem strange that you could ever lose someone or get lost." Bix knows, you think. He's always known, in front of that computer, and now he's passing the knowledge on. But what you say is, "Will you finally get to meet Lizzie's parents?" The surprise lands cleanly in Bix's face, and he laughs, a big billowing noise. "I don't know, Rob," he says, shaking his head. "Maybe not. Maybe that part will never change. But I like to think so." He rubs his eyes, which look suddenly tired, and says, "Speaking of which, time to head back home." He walks away, hands in the pockets of his army jacket, but it's a while before it feels like he's really gone. You pull your last joint from your wallet and smoke it with Drew, walking south. The river is quiet, no boats in sight, a couple of toothless geezers fishing under the Williamsburg Bridge. "Drew," you say. He's looking at the water with that stone distraction that makes anything seem worth studying. You laugh, nervous, and he turns. "What?" "I wish we could live in that cabin, you and me." "What cabin?" "The one you built in Wisconsin." You see confusion in Drew's face and you add, "If there is a cabin." "Of course there's a cabin." Your high granulates the air, then Drew's face, which reconstitutes with a new wariness in it that frightens you. "I would miss Sasha," he says slowly. "Wouldn't you?" "You don't really know her," you say, breathless, a little desperate. "You don't know who you'd be missing." A massive storage hangar has intervened between the path and the river, and you walk alongside it. "What don't I know about Sasha?" Drew asks in his usual friendly tone. "But it's different." You sense him already turning away, and you start to panic. "She was a hooker," you say. "A hooker and a thief. That's how she survived in Naples." As you speak these words, a howling starts up in your ears. Drew stops walking. You're sure he's going to hit you, and you wait for it. "That's insane," he says, "and fuck you for saying it." "Ask her," you shout, to be heard above the howling. "Ask about Lars the Swede, who used to play the flute." Drew starts walking again, his head down. You walk beside him, your steps narrating your panic. "What have you done? What have you done? What have you done? What have you done?" The FDR is over your heads, tires roaring, gasoline in your lungs. Drew stops again. He looks at you through the dim, oily air as if he's never seen you before. "Wow, Rob," he says, "you are really and truly an asshole. You're the last to know. Not me, Sasha." He turns and walks quickly away, leaving you alone. You charge after him, seized by a wild conviction that containing Drew will seal off the damage you've done. "She doesn't know," you tell herself. "She still doesn't know. As long as Drew is in sight, she doesn't know." You stalk him along the river's edge, maybe 20 feet between you, half running to keep up. He turns once. "Go away! I don't want to be near you." But you sense his confusion about where to go, what to do, and it reassures you somehow. Nothing has happened yet. Between the Manhattan and Brooklyn bridges, Drew stops beside what might be called a beach. It's made entirely out of garbage. Old tires, trash, splintered wood and glass and filthy paper, and old plastic bags tapering gradually into the East River. Drew stands on this rubble looking out, and you wait a few feet behind him. Then he begins to undress. You don't believe it's happening at first. Off comes its jacket, his sweater, his two T-shirts, and undershirt. And there is Drew's bare torso, strong and tight as you'd imagined, though thinner, the dark hair on his chest in the shape of a spade. In jeans and boots, Drew picks his way to where garbage and water meet. An angular slab of concrete juts out, the failed foundation of something long forgotten, and he scrambles on top of it. He unlaces his boots and removes them, then kicks off his jeans and boxers. Even through your dread, you feel a faint appreciation for the beauty and inelegance of a man undressing. He glances back at you, and you glimpse his naked front, the dark pubic hair and strong legs. "I've always wanted to do this," he says in a flat voice, and takes a long, leaping, shallow dive, slamming the East River surface and letting out something between a scream and a gasp. He surfaces, and you hear him trying to catch his breath. It can't be more than 45 degrees out. You climb the slab of concrete and start taking off clothes, sodden with dread but moved by a flickering sense that if you can master this dread, it will mean something, prove something about you. Your scars twang in the cold. Your dick is shriveled to the size of a walnut, and your football bulk is starting to slide. But Drew isn't even watching you. He's swimming, strong, clear swimmer's strokes. You make a clumsy leap, your body crashing onto the water, your knee hitting something hard under the surface. The cold locks in around you, knocking out your breath. You swim crazily to get away from the garbage, which you picture underneath, rusty hooks and claws reaching up to slash your genitals and feet. Your knee aches from whatever it hit. You lift up your head and see Drew floating on his back. "We can get back out of here, right?" you yell. "Yes, Rob," he answers in that new flat voice. "Same way we got in." You don't say anything else. It takes all your strength to tread water and yank in breath. Eventually, without your noticing, the cold begins to feel almost tropically warm against your skin. The shrieking in your ears subsides and you can breathe again. You look around, startled by the mythic beauty of what surrounds you. Water encircling an island, a distant tugboat jutting out its rubbery lip, the Statue of Liberty, a thunder of wheels on the Brooklyn Bridge, which looks like the inside of a harp, church bells meandering and off-key like the chimes your mother hangs on the porch. You're moving fast, and when you look for Drew, you can't find him at first. The shore is far away. A person is swimming near it, but at such a distance that when the swimmer pauses, waving frantic arms, you can't see who it is. You hear a faint shout, "Rob!" and realize you've been hearing that voice for a while. Panic scissors through you, bringing crystalline engagements with physical facts. You're caught in a current. There are currents in this river. You knew that. Heard it somewhere and forgot. You shout, but feel the smallness of your voice, the seismic indifference of the water around you. All this in an instant. "Help! Drew!" As you flail, knowing you're not supposed to panic, panicking will drain your strength, your mind pulls away as it does so easily, so often, without your even noticing sometimes, leaving Robert Freeman Jr. to manage the current alone while you withdraw to the broader landscape, the water and buildings and streets, the avenues like endless hallways, your dorm full of sleeping students, the air thick with the communal breath. You slip through Sasha's open window, floating over the sill lined with artifacts from her travels. A white seashell, a small gold pagoda, a pair of red dice. Her harp in one corner with its small wood stool. She's asleep in her narrow bed, her burned red hair dark against the sheets. You kneel beside her, breathing the familiar smell of Sasha's sleep, whispering into her ear some mix of, "I'm sorry, and I believe in you, and I'll always be near you, protecting you, and I will never leave you. I'll be curled around your heart for the rest of your life, until the water pressing my shoulders and chest crushes me awake, and I hear Sasha screaming into my face, 'Fight! Fight! Fight!'" And that story was Out of Body by Jennifer Egan, from the Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. Horse in the Moon by Luigi Pirandello. In September, upon that high and arid clayey plain, jutting perilously over the African Sea, the melancholy countryside still lay parched from the merciless summer sun. It was still shaggy with blackened stubble, while a sprinkling of almond trees and a few aged olive trunks were to be seen here and there. Nevertheless, it had been decided that the bridal pair should spend at least the first few days of their honeymoon in this place to oblige the bridegroom. The wedding feast, which was held in a room of the old deserted villa, was far from being a festive occasion for the invited guests. None of those present was able to overcome the embarrassment, or rather the feeling of dismay, inspired in him by the aspect and bearing of that fleshy youth, barely 20 years of age, with the purplish face and the little darting black eyes, which were preternaturally bright, like a madman's. The latter no longer heard what was being said around him. He did not eat, and he did not drink, but became, from moment to moment, redder and more purple of countenance. Everyone knew that he had been madly in love with the one who now sat beside him as his bride, and that he had done perfectly mad things on her account, even to the point of attempting to kill himself. He was very rich, the sole heir to the Bernardi fortune, while she, after all, was only the daughter of an infantry colonel who had come there the year before with his regiment from Sicily. But in spite of this, the colonel, who had been warned against the inhabitants of the island, had been reluctant about giving his consent to this match, for the reason that he had not wanted to leave his daughter there among people that were little better than savages. The dismay which the bridegroom's aspect and actions inspired in the guests increased when the latter came to contrast him with his extremely young bride. She was really but a child, fresh, vivacious, and aloof. It seemed she always shook off every unpleasant thought with a liveliness that was at once charming, ingenuous, and roguish. Roguish as that of a little tomboy who as yet knows nothing of the world. A half-orphan, she had grown up without a mother's care, and indeed it was all too evident that she was going into matrimony without any preparation whatsoever. Everyone smiled, but everyone felt a chill when at the end of the meal she turned to the bridegroom and exclaimed, "For goodness sake, Nino, why do you make those little tiny eyes? Let me. No, they burn. Why do your hands burn like that? Feel, Papa, feel how hot his hands are. Do you suppose he has fever?" The colonel, on pins and needles, did what he could to speed up the departure of the countryside guests. He wanted to put an end to a spectacle that impressed him as being indecent. They all piled into half-dozen carriages. The one in which the colonel and the bridegroom's widowed mother rode proceeded slowly down the lane and lagged a little behind, for the reason that the bridal couple, one on one side and one on the other, holding hands with the mother and father, had wanted to follow a short distance on foot down to where the highway which led to the distant city began. At that point the colonel leaned down and kissed his daughter on the head. He coughed and muttered, "Goodbye, Nino." "Goodbye, Ida," said the bridegroom's mother with a laugh, and the carriage rattled away at a good pace in order to overtake the others. The two stood there for a moment gazing after it, but it was really only Ida who gazed, for Nino saw nothing, was conscious of nothing. His eyes were fastened upon his bride as she stood there, alone with him at last. His, all his. But what was this? Was she weeping? "Daddy," said Ida, as she waved her handkerchief in farewell. "There, do you see? He, too." "No, Ida, Ida dear," and stammering, almost sobbing, trembling violently, Nino made an effort to embrace her. Ida pushed him away. "No, let me alone, please. I just wanted to dry your eyes." "Thanks, my dear. I'll dry them myself." Nino stood there awkwardly. His face, as he looked at her, was pitiful to behold, and his mouth was half open. Ida finished drying her eyes. "But what's the matter?" she asked him. "You're trembling all over." "No, no, Nino, for heaven's sake, no, don't stand there like that. You make me laugh, and if I once start laughing, you'll see, I'll never stop. Wait a minute, I'll wake you up." She put her hands on his temples and blew in his eyes. At the touch of those fingers, at the breath from those lips, he felt his legs giving way beneath him. He was about to sink down on one knee, but she held him up and burst into a loud laugh. "Upon the highway? Are you crazy? Come on, let's go. Look at that little hill over there. We shall be able to see the carriages still. Let's go look. And she impetuously dragged him away by one arm. From all the countryside round about, where so many weeds and grasses, so many things dispersed by the hand of time lay withered, there mounted into the heat-ridden air something like a dense and ancient drouth, mingling with the warm, heavy odor of the manure that lay fermenting in little piles upon the fallow fields, and with the sharper fragrance of sage and wild mint. Of that dense drouth, those warm and heavy odors, that piercing fragrance, he alone was aware. She, as she ran, could hear how gaily the woodlark sang up to the sun, from behind the thick hedges and from between the rugged yellowish tufts of burnt-over stubble. She could hear it, too, in that impressive silence, the prophetic crow of cocks from distant barnyards, and she felt herself wrapped every now and again in the cool, keen breath that came up from the neighboring sea, to stir the few tired and yellowed leaves that were left on the almond trees and the close, clustering, sharp-pointed, ashen-hued olive leaves. It did not take them long to reach the hilltop, but he was so exhausted from running that he could no longer stand. He wanted to sit down and tried to make her sit down also, there on the ground beside him, with his arm around her waist. But Ida put him off with, "Let me have a look first." She was beginning to feel restless inside, but she did not care to show it. Irritated by a certain strange and curious stubbornness on his part, she could not, she would not, stand still, but longed to keep on fleeing, still farther away. She wanted to shake him up, to distract him, to distract herself as well, so long as the day lasted. Down there on the other side of the hill, there stretched away a devastated plain, a sea of stubble, amid which one could make out occasionally the black and meandering traces of wood ashes that had been sprinkled there. Now and again, too, the crude yellow gleam was broken by a few clumps of caper or of licorice. Away over there, as if on the other shore of that vast yellow sea, the roofs of a hamlet rose from the dark, tall poplars. And now Ida suggested to her husband that they go over there, all the way over to that hamlet. How long would it take? An hour or less. It was not more than 5 o'clock. Back home in the villa, the servants must still be busy clearing away the things. They would be home before evening. Nino made a feeble attempt at opposition, but she took him by the hands and dragged him to his feet. In a moment she was running down the side of the hill and was off through that sea of stubble, as light and quick as a young doe. He was not fast enough to keep up with her, but redder face than ever, and seemingly stunned by it all, ran after her, pantingly and perspiringly, and kept calling to her to wait and give him her hand. "Give me your hand, at least give me your hand," he shouted. All of a sudden she uttered a cry and stopped short. A flock of cawing ravens had just flown up from in front of her, and there in front of her, stretched out upon the earth, was a dead horse. Dead? No, no, it wasn't dead. It had its eyes open. Heavens, what eyes! What eyes! A skeleton, that's what it was, and those ribs, and those flanks. Nino came up, fuming and fretting. "Come on, let's go. Let's go back at once." "It's alive, look," cried Ida, shivering from compassion. "Lift its head. Heavens, what eyes! Look, Nino." "Yes, yes," said he, panting still. "They've just put it out here. Leave it alone. Let's go. What a sight! Don't you smell?" "And those ravens," she exclaimed with a shudder. "Are those ravens going to eat it alive?" "But Ida, for heaven's sakes," he implored her, clasping his hands. "Nino, that will do," she cried. It was more than she could endure to see him so stupid and so contrite. "Answer me. What if they eat it alive?" "What do I know about whether or not they'll eat it? They'll wait. Until it dies here of hunger or of thirst?" Her face was all drawn with horror and pity. "Just because it's old? Because it can't work any more? Ah, poor beast, what a shame! What a shame! Haven't they any heart, those peasants? Haven't you any heart, standing there like that?" "Excuse me," he said, losing his temper, "but you feel so much sympathy for an animal. And oughtn't I too? But you don't feel any for me. And are you an animal? Are you dying of hunger and thirst as you sit there in the stubble? You feel, oh, look at the ravens, Nino, look up there, circling around. Oh, what a horrible, shameful, monstrous thing. Look, oh, the poor beast. Try to lift him up. Come, Nino, get up. Maybe he can still walk. Nino, get up. Help me. Shake yourself out of it. But what do you expect me to do? He burst out exasperatedly. Do you expect me to drag him back? Put him on my shoulders? What's a horse, more or less? How do you think he's going to walk? Can't you see he's half dead? But if we brought him something to eat... And to drink, too? Oh, Nino, you're wicked! And the tears stood in Ida's eyes. Overcoming her shudders, she bent over very gently to caress the horse's head. The animal, with a great effort, had managed to get to its knees, and even in its last degrading agony it showed the traces of a noble beauty in head and neck. Nino, owing possibly to the blood that was pounding in his veins, possibly owing to the bitterness and contempt she had manifested, or to the perspiration that was trickling from him, now suddenly felt his breath failing him. He grew giddy, his teeth began chattering, and he was conscious of a weird trembling all over his body. He instinctively turned up his coat collar, and with his hands in his pockets went over and huddled down in gloomy despair upon a rock some distance away. The sun had already set, and from the distant highway could be heard the occasional sound of horses' bells. Why were his teeth chattering like that? For his forehead was burning up, the blood in his veins stung him, and there was a roaring in his ears. It seemed to him that he could hear so many faraway bells. All that anxiety, that spasm of expectation, her coldness and caprice, that last foot race, and that horse there, that cursed horse. Oh, God, was it a dream? A nightmare within a dream? Did he have a fever? Or perhaps a worse illness. Ah, how dark it was! God, how dark! And now his sight was clouding over. He tried to call, Ida! Ida! But he could not get the words out of his parched throat. Where was Ida? What was she doing? She had gone off to the distant hamlet to seek aid for that horse. She did not stop to think that the peasants had brought the animal there to die. He remained there alone upon the rock, a prey to those growing tremors, and as he sat there, huddled to himself like a great owl upon a perch, he suddenly beheld the sight that seemed, ah, yes, he could see it plainly enough now, an atrocious sight, like a vision from another world, the moon, a huge moon coming slowly up from behind that sea of stubble. And black against that enormous, vapory copper disk, the headstrong head of that horse, waiting still with its neck stretched out. It had, perhaps, been waiting like that always, darkly etched upon that copper disk, while from far up in the sky could be heard the caw of circling ravens. When Ida, angry and disillusioned, came groping her way back over the plain, calling, Nino! Nino! The moon had already risen. The horse had dropped down as if dead. And Nino, where was Nino? Oh, there he was over there. He was on the ground, too. Had he fallen asleep there? She ran up to him and found him with a death rattle in his throat. His face also was on the ground. It was almost black, and his eyes, nearly closed, were puffed and bloodshot. Oh, God! She looked about her as if in a swoon. She opened her hands, which held a few dried beans that she'd brought from the hamlet over there to feed the horse. She looked at the moon, then at the horse, then at the man lying on the ground as if dead. She felt faint, assailed as she was by the sudden suspicion that everything she saw was unreal. Terrified, she fled back to the villa, calling in a loud voice for her father, to come and take her away. Oh, God, away from that man with the rattle in his throat, that rattle, the meaning of which she did not understand. Away from that horse, away from under that mad moon, away from under those cawing ravens in the sky. Away! 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 And that story was Horse in the Moon by Luigi Pirandello from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. The next story is from Sudden Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Billy's Girl by Gordon Jackson. First Billy was on the raft, and then he was not. Sun shone on the blue water. Carmine looked for him in the bathhouse, at the popcorn stand where he liked to waste time with Camille, then down by the lifeguard station. But nobody had seen him. "If I catch that kid," Carmine said to me in the bathhouse, but I hadn't seen him either. What could I see from behind the counter there except a little stretch of open water? The sun bright on the big lake, pines in the distance. Occasionally some queenie would stroll by, but I hadn't seen Billy at all. He could still be out there hiding among the big float tanks underneath the boards, his break over, turn up later, rake in hand. Why, Mr. D'Angelo, I've been clearing up this area like you told me to. It would be just like him. But after a while they called the sheriff, and two guys came into the bathhouse behind me and went into the storeroom where they keep the drag lines, these hooks as big as your head. By then it was late afternoon. The sheriff's guys were out there in their little boat, putt-putting around the raft, lines hanging over the stern, when Billy's girlfriend came down that evening for a swim. When it was completely dark, they switched on lights and kept at it. "He's only kidding, the way he always does," Billy's girlfriend said to me. She was perched on the edge of my counter, swinging her legs, looking real good and knowing it. By then the place was pretty well cleared out. We went behind the rows of wire baskets and started to make out. There was nobody around. It was dark, and we sort of sank down on a pile of wet towels. Right away she stuck her tongue in my mouth. The towels gave off a sour odor. Her suit was still damp around the edges, I noticed. Out on the lake the motor died down again. Every so often they had to ease off, something tangled in the lines, seaweed or an old log. But this time it was Billy all right, like a big muskie with all the fight gone out of him, hooked right through the eye, the deputy said. By then I was into Billy's girlfriend pretty good, and she was liking it. And that story was Billy's Girl by Gordon Jackson from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.